Well, our presentation today is Miracles of Spring, presented by Eileen Hakus, who's sitting right here in the second row. Eileen Hakus, M.A., is a member of Prairie, and she earned her master's degree in psychology from Antioch University. She's a certified clinical hypnotherapist and former owner of the Alchemy Institute of Hypnotherapy in Denver, Colorado. She served as a minister for Unitarian Universalist Fellowships in Pagosa Springs, Colorado, and Sedona, Arizona, and has presented homilies to UU congregations in Durango, Colorado, Prescott, Arizona, St. John, and the U.S. Virgin Islands, and I will have to add this too because she's done a service before here. Welcome, Eileen.
Morning. This morning, I'd like to talk about miracles, and one sort of miracle in particular, the miracle of transformation. We observe this miracle in nature with the arrival of spring. March 20th was the vernal equinox, when in the northern hemisphere, the length of days began to increase. Predating Christianity in Europe, pagan rituals were performed to celebrate this time of year. One example was the German custom of the sun wheel. A wooden wheel was rolled to the top of a high hill, set on fire, and then rolled down into the village fields, symbolizing the warmth and energy of the sun, returning for the spring plowing and planting. People depended upon the return of longer days and the regeneration of the earth after months of cold, barren winter for their very survival. Other pagan symbols, such as eggs and rabbits, remain with us, representing the fertility and rebirth of spring. The name of the pagan goddess of spring, Eostar, is generally accepted as the origin of the name of Easter. The theme of transformation and renewal is important to our collective human consciousness. It comforts us and guarantees us the continuation of life. It is fitting, then, that the biblical stories of Easter and Passover occur in the spring. As Unitarian Universalists, we may find it challenging to open our hearts and minds to a deeper understanding of the stories upon which these holidays are based. But since our roots are Judeo-Christian, it is worth our effort. As children, we enjoyed celebrating these holidays. As Christians, we dyed eggs, ate jelly beans, and listened to stories about the miracle of Jesus' death and resurrection. As Jews, we prepared for the gathering of friends and relatives for the Seder, where we would hear retold the tale of our ancestors' exodus from Egypt, the miracle of the 10 plagues, and the parting of the Red Sea. As adults, many of us have rejected elements of these stories as historically inaccurate or scientifically implausible and therefore of little value. However, they have served as the foundation for much of humanity's cultural and religious practices for thousands of years and have a power we must acknowledge. Perhaps their influence arose from a theme which struck a chord deep within our ancestral psyche. This theme has also been symbolized by the phoenix, a mythical bird which rises from the ashes of destruction. It is, in fact, the message of hope and new beginnings. The story of Easter, of course, is told in four books of the New Testament, Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John. While there is some variation between the four accounts, they all posit a similar version of events. Saturday evening after the Sabbath, Mary Magdalene went to the tomb where Jesus was taken after having been removed from the cross. When she arrived, she was surprised to see that the stone placed in front of the tomb had been rolled aside. Entering, she saw a young man clothed in a white robe who told her that her rabbi had risen from the dead. She was instructed to go tell the other disciples that Jesus was going to Galilee and that he would meet them there. Sometimes I contemplate possible scientific explanations for events recounted in the Gospels. For example, in Matthew 28:2, where it is written, "There was a violent earthquake, for an angel of the Lord came down from heaven and rolled back the stone." I wonder, did an angel roll back the stone causing an earthquake? Or was there an earthquake which dislodged the stone? Of even greater interest is the question of whether Jesus rose from the dead or was taken down from the cross while he was still alive. According to the New Living Translation of the Bible, the crucifixion happened on Friday, the day before the Sabbath. As evening approached, an honored member of the High Council, Joseph of Arimathea, went to Pontius Pilate to ask for Jesus' body. Since Jesus had only been on the cross for 2 to 3 hours, Pilate didn't believe that he was dead and only released the body to Joseph after a Roman military officer confirmed that he was. After Joseph took Jesus' body down from the cross, he wrapped it in cloth and laid it in the tomb that had been prepared for him. However, despite the Roman officer's testimony, many scholars believe that Jesus was still alive when he was removed from the cross. One such individual is Holger Kirsten. He wrote a book entitled Jesus Lived in India, a methodical and authoritative examination of Christ's life beyond the crucifixion. Kirsten's exhaustive research found evidence that Christ traveled to India after the crucifixion and lived there for many years before his death and entombment in Kashmir. He references more than 21 historical documents that bear witness to the existence of Jesus in Kashmir, where he was known also as Yus Asaf and Isa. The Quran, which refers to Jesus as Isar, supports Kirsten's claims. The Kurdish tribes of eastern Anatolia have several stories describing Christ's stay in eastern Turkey after his resurrection. The founder of the Al-Mihdaya movement in Islam, Hadrat Mirza Ghulam Ahmad, who died in 1908, also wrote about the escape of Jesus from death on the cross and his journey to India. He cites Christian as well as Muslim scriptures and old medical and historical books, including ancient Buddhist records, to provide evidence about this journey. According to Ahmad, Jesus reached Afghanistan, where he met Jews who had settled there after deliverance from the bondage of Nebuchadnezzar. From Afghanistan, Jesus went to Kashmir, where other Israelite tribes had settled. There he made his home and died at over 100 years of age. Further evidence is found in the Apocrypha, texts said to have been written by the apostle, which are not officially accepted by the church. The apocryphal Acts of Thomas, for example, tells how Christ met Thomas several times after the crucifixion. Official church doctrine regards all such claims to be heretical, but Kirsten maintains that one can hardly restrict oneself to information about Jesus found in the Gospels and the work of church theologians, as such sources, quote, have an obvious interest in maintaining the authority of the church and its grip on the masses, unquote. But even if the biblical account of the crucifixion and resurrection of Jesus is not completely factual, does that mean it has no importance? To the contrary, this parable of death and rebirth offers us one of the greatest teachings in life. First, the death and resurrection of Jesus reminds us that on the other side of endings are new beginnings. Unitarian Universalist minister and author William Hoff writes, "There are few things more difficult in life than starting over. And yet that is what life is all about, being born and dying and being born again. Each beginning is unique. We have never met it before. And initially we wonder how we will ever meet its challenges. Beginnings are such a problem for some people that they decide they will have no more. They have arrived. They may even try to go back. But existence is not put together that way. And when we elect to allow no more beginnings, we open the way for the dyings to take over. Death and rebirth, each is contained in the other. Rhythm and balance, within which lies the wholeness of life. Hoff continues, we may grieve a significant change in our lives. Death, as loss, is a change, and it is not wrong to grieve. But if we do not grow, we make no progress. A similar interpretation, understood by those whose lives are motivated by personal and spiritual growth, is that Jesus' death and resurrection symbolize the death of the ego and transformation of the egoist personality into enlightened awareness. It is, in fact, when our egos are on the cross that we are most open to letting go of limiting beliefs. It is in times of greatest personal challenge, what some have termed the dark night of the soul, that we are most likely to confront our inner demons, emerging with greater strength, understanding, and higher levels of consciousness. Great wisdom most often arises after things we've held most dear have crumbled and disappeared. Now, this teaching is not a justification for or rationalization of pain and loss, and is certainly not a recommendation to deny the feelings that accompany those experiences in our lives. Grief is real and important. What is depression if not in part the repression of sadness and anger associated with grief? In fact, years of experience of a psychotherapist have taught me that healing only occurs when we allow ourselves to feel our emotions deeply. But when this occurs, one achieves a profound understanding about oneself and life that did not exist before. This evolution in consciousness also inevitably leads to a greater sense of compassion for others, a deeper appreciation of love, and a profound openness to receiving life's gifts with awe and gratitude. This offers at least some explanation as to why the story of Jesus' death and resurrection has endured. It gives us hope and teaches us that pain, as well as pleasure, may serve as a catalyst for profound and positive transformation. While the Easter story illustrates this point on a personal level, the Passover story illustrates a similar phenomenon taking place within an entire community. About 3,000 years ago, the Israelites were enslaved by the Egyptians under the rule of Pharaoh Ramses II. According to the biblical book of Exodus, Moses, a simple Jewish shepherd, was instructed by God to go to Pharaoh and demand the freedom of his people. When Pharaoh ignored God's message, a series of 10 plagues befell the people of Egypt: blood, frogs, lice, wild beasts, cattle disease, boils, hail, locusts, darkness, and the slaying of the firstborn. The holiday's name Passover is derived from the instructions given to Moses by God to protect the Jews during the last plague. They were told to mark the doorways of their dwellings with lamb's blood so that the angel of death could identify and pass over their homes. After the last plague, the Israelites were given their freedom. However, once the Jews had left Egypt, the Pharaoh had a change of heart, and his army chased them through the desert toward the Red Sea. There the Jews were trapped, but another miracle occurred. The waves of the Red Sea parted, and they were able to cross to the other side. When Pharaoh's army followed behind them, the waves closed in and swept them away. As with the biblical story of the resurrection of Jesus, rationalists provide us with scientific explanations for the 10 plagues which befell Egypt and the events which followed at the Red Sea. First, let's consider some scientific explanations behind some of the 10 plagues. To unleash the first plague, blood, upon the Egyptians, Moses struck the River Nile with his staff, turning its waters red. According to the biblical book of Exodus, after the waters turned to blood, the fish in the Nile died, and the water stank, so that the Egyptians could not drink it. Scientists posit that the sudden appearance of red water in the Nile could have been caused by a bloom of red algae. Certain conditions enable a type of microscopic algae to reproduce in such great numbers that the water appears to be stained a bloody red. When this happens in oceans, the phenomenon is known as red tide. But according to scientists, red algae blooms may also occur in rivers. Red algae contains a toxin that can poison the invertebrates that feed upon it, subsequently affecting animals further up the food chain. After the Egyptians' water supply turned into blood, a second plague descended upon the Egyptians, frogs. According to the Bible, frogs swarmed into people's homes, beds, and ovens. But was that a miracle? According to the Bible, frogs, the phenomenon of raining frogs, has been reported multiple times throughout history and in a range of locations around the world. The third plague, translated from the Hebrew word kinim, could mean either lice or fleas. If a toxic algae bloom led to the first plague and a pile of dead frogs followed, it is not surprising that a swarm of insects would have appeared next. Both body lice and fleas can transmit the bacteria which causes bubonic plague. That, in turn, could have set the stage for later plagues, such as boils, which commonly appear on the skin of plague victims. Scientists have also argued that the sickness that killed off the livestock of the Egyptians in the fifth plague might have been caused by insects from the third. What about the miracle of the crossing of the Red Sea? Some modern archaeologists maintain that the Israelites crossed a shallow lake north of the Red Sea called the Reed Sea. The term used in the Hebrew Bible is Yam Suf. Yam means sea, and Suf means reeds. Scholars hypothesize that the Israelites were able to walk across the sea atop the reeds, while the Egyptians, laden with heavy armor and riding chariots, got bogged down and drowned. But miraculous or not, we might consider the deeper meaning of the story. Here you have an entire people enslaved in Egypt for generations, when suddenly they are redeemed. They embark upon a journey in the desert which lasts 40 years before they entered a promised land where their children build new lives. The trial experienced by the Jews during their enslavement in Egypt and their arduous journey to a new land transformed them and left an indelible mark upon the soul of a people. In retelling this story to successive generations at the Passover Seder for over 3,000 years, the Jewish people are reminded to appreciate their freedom and to place inestimable value upon a homeland where they rule themselves. Moreover, the Ten Commandments launched human society into a kind of social structure unbeknownst to human culture up until then. Much of the world was transformed by having new religious and ethical principles to guide it. This past year, many of us experienced profound life changes. The most difficult may have been the death of a spouse, family member, or friend. Other endings may have involved saying goodbye to a marriage, home, or career. But we have also seen that even as we say goodbye, life offers us new possibilities. We arrive at the beginning of spring, ready for the new, ready for long, sunlit days and blooming flowers. The rebirth of the earth gives us hope. Because the earth has a way of renewing itself, so therefore may we. The Reverend Lisa Friedman wrote, These are the Easter moments when the hope of our hearts is resurrected out of our tears of pain and despair. They remind us that even in the presence of death, there is always an opportunity to begin again. May we rejoice in a world which has the awesome power to renew itself and remove death's sting with love. What more of a miracle do we need?